Welcome, everyone. Welcome. Welcome. Great to see you. I hope one is a Gurdjieffian. Anyway, I always like to begin the program by remembering my guru, Swami Muktananda, who always said at the beginning of all of his programs in Hindi, "Sabko bade sammane ke saath prem se adhik swagat." With great respect and love, I welcome you all with all my heart. And he would say that that welcome is the essence of spirituality, welcome another person with love. So in that spirit, I want to welcome you. And also, loads of people watching on the internet, the global satsang. Let's see, in the U.S., in New York and Ann Arbor, in Canada, in Hungary, in Japan, and all around Australia, including Adelaide, and then lots of people watching in Brisbane. Three different places in Brisbane, and in Byron Bay, and on the Sunshine Coast, and then here in Melbourne, and even in the ashram, we have several sick ashramites. Well, we have a lot of sick ashramites, but a few are ill also. And they're all watching. And up in Sydney, hello everyone. So before I get to the main business, I wanted to share a little bit. This is from a recent New Yorker magazine. I have a long addiction to the New Yorker. I don't know whether this will increase it or decrease it. There's an article on pain, and there's a whole study of pain. How does pain work? What part of the brain reacts when you have pain, and so on. And so the writer's talking about one of the experiments, and she writes, one of her, this is the scientist's, most striking experiments tested the common observation that religious faith helps people cope with pain. Comparing the neurological responses of devout Catholics with those of atheists, she found that the two groups had similar baseline experiences of pain, but that if the subjects were shown a picture of the Virgin Mary by Sassoferrato, this one, and actually this is from National Gallery has this, although actually Sassoferrato made many such ones. He's an Italian Baroque painter. The subjects were shown this picture while the pain was administered, the believers rated their discomfort nearly a point lower than the atheists did. So if you're a believer, you can look at that. You'll have less pain. But we can't do much for you if you're an atheist. And then, when the volunteers were shown a secular painting, one of the most famous ones by Leonardo, the lady with an ermine. What? Wawa. When they showed this to both the believers and non-believers, their response was the same. Because even though by painterly standards this is a greater work, but by spiritual standards it's a point worse. The writer says, the implications are potentially far-reaching, and not only because they suggest that cultural attitudes may have a neurological imprint. If faith engages a neural mechanism with analgesic benefits, the Catholics showed heightened activity in an area usually associated with the ability to override a physical response. And this is the payoff line. It may be possible to find other secular ways to to engage that circuit. So we can look forward. We won't have to be spiritual. They can engage that circuit in other secular ways, and we can give up doing this and have bliss and joy without having to go through all the nastiness of God. So I'm looking forward to mundane methods of transcendental bliss. So let's watch this space and we'll find them. Then we'll get rid of all this chanting and all the mantras and gurus and all that stuff. No? Anyway, there you go. I'm always ready. I want to keep you abreast of latest developments, the cutting edge of everything. Okay. So tonight, that was all right, wasn't it? Did I say anything wrong? Okay. Well, then I'll try again harder. Okay, so tonight, as I said, our main topic is the great Western spiritual teacher, G.I. Gurdjieff. And there he is in his mysterious young form. And here he is in his mysterious old form. Even the date that you see there, his birth date, is a mystery too. He's been dated between 1866 and 1878 as his birth date. So 1872 is just a good guess. But we know that he died in 1949. I guess you can leave him up there. So he was a great and influential spiritual teacher. Perhaps the first sort of Western guru to emerge. He grew up in Eastern Turkey. His father was Greek. You're all being mesmerized by him. He had, you know, mesmeric powers, so I think we better turn him off. I can feel him sucking your consciousness out of you. And I'm very jealous, so cut that out. So his father was Greek and his mother was Armenian, and he grew up in what is now Eastern Turkey. And I was introduced to Gurdjieff's teachings even before I met Ramdas. He was the first spiritual teacher that I read anything about. In fact, should I tell you the story? It's kind of a dumb story, but... What?
Just tell it.
All right, okay. My college girlfriend, Brucelle, after we broke up, she was dating a guy who was a Gurdjieffian, and she used to tell me about Gurdjieff, and I used to think that was silly. I used to call him Handkerchief. And so I just want to say in front of you all that Brucelle was right. And I was wrong. And Chandralekha, you can call Brucelle up and tell her that I mentioned her in the program, okay? All right, anyway, while we were driving to India, and we were going through Eastern Turkey, I was thinking about him a lot, and we were reading Meetings with Remarkable Men, which is his memoir. It tells about his studies. It's a very strange book. Full of mystery. He studied with Sufi masters in the East, but his accounts were always suspicious. If you read Gurdjieff literature, you'll find that he's a complete man of mystery. He may have been a Russian spy, a Tibetan monk, or all kinds of things. So whatever he says is always suspicious, and he's a big jokester. So he kept a lot of his past hidden. But at the beginning of this First World War, he emerged into the West, came from the East there, Turkey, and he went to Paris, he went to New York. He caused a stir among the intelligentsia in New York. I mean, they didn't have a context. After 1970, a lot of gurus were coming to the West, But in 1920, 1930, it was very unknown. So he gave, he was at Carnegie Hall in New York, and he gave mysterious talks and dance recitals. And the New Yorker, in 1930, noticed his presence, calling him a philosopher, and mentioned that he held court several times a day in two different restaurants. There's a chain of restaurants in New York called Child's. So he would go from one Child's to the other, in which he drank endless coffee. Never ate there, just drank coffee and met people. And the New Yorker of the time said the people who followed him tended to be, and this is their words, aesthetes and ladies who think deeply. Why does that give me so much pleasure? Aesthetes and ladies who think deeply. That would never get to the New Yorker in print these days, would it? Anyway, his basic teaching, we don't want to see him yet. His basic teachings were very familiar. They're yoga teachings. He says, in our present state, the way he said it, man is a machine. Man is a machine. That is purely mechanical, the result of our upbringing and early training, and we don't have real choice. We're just on automatic pilot. We're wind-up dolls. And he says, however, a person can develop choice by doing the work, which we would call sadhana, spiritual practice. By working on yourself, you can develop that. Gurdjieff said the work begins with self-observation, which was simply watching the way you react to everything. What is this mechanism doing? Now it gets uptight, now it gets angry, now it gets this, and reacts and watches. And he says, just watch that, and you'll hear something about that. And then after you establish in that, then you can do self-remembering, which is to remember the I thought. And he would draw an arrow which pointed in two directions. And he said, usually attention goes outward. Like, I'm looking, I see Premji over there, I'm seeing Premji, but I should have the memory of me too, so that it's I am seeing Premji. So it's not just Premji, but I'm seeing Premji. That's called self-remembering. So you're remembering the self. And so, and as you do that work, and it's very similar to mantra, it's very similar to Ramana's Who Am I, or Nisargadatta's I Am, it's very similar practice. As you do that work, he explained that you develop certain chemicals. You transform consciousness. It's an interesting description of it because it does feel chemical. Somebody told me right on the darshan line that the mantra chemically changes every cell. Didn't you tell me that? Yeah, and you can feel it. And Gurdjieff said it would change the carbons or the hydrogens or something. He had a whole system. And that you gain a higher energy, and as long as you don't go in the wrong direction, you can build that higher energy. And so the work consists of waking up and building our consciousness and getting rid of negative mental and emotional tendencies, useless ones, jealousy, paranoia, fear, anger, depression. And these he called leaks. These were leaks where the system leaks and we leak away the higher energy and bring ourselves down. And when you have leaks, you quickly lose that higher energy that your practice builds. And if you can build it, then what you attain is a center of gravity. He called it permanent I. You develop a permanent I. And he says, as you'll see in the piece, that unawakened people don't have a self. Of course, in our model, we say, the self exists always within, but it may be hidden. But he said, you don't. You have to build the self, you do have to build permanent I. You establish the self in being one person. He says, unawakened people have many eyes. There's angry me, sad me, happy me, friendly me, paranoid me, and these are all like different eyes. We react differently, we respond differently, and we have different kinds of thoughts. So this is Gurdjieff. Now, he would probably be less known except for a great interpreter and student of his, a Russian mathematician, philosopher named P.D. Uspensky, who wrote the book that I was studying back in the 60s called Happy for No Good Reason.
No.
In Search of the Miraculous, it was called. A really terrific read. I recommend that book. But please skip the chapters where it gets really way too out. If you start feeling the chapters going crazy, go to the next chapter. And there's a lot of great stuff in it. So this is Uspensky, solid, vital, or peculiar? Extremely solid. He popularized Gurdjieff by this book, and he became a teacher himself. His third eye can kill, so don't look at it directly. Yeah. So, and one of his students, who was also a student of Gurdjieff, was Morris Nicol. And he's an English psychotherapist. He studied with Jung, and he met Uspensky in 1921. He's more friendly, isn't he?
Yeah.
And he spent 1922 with Gurdjieff in France, and then Uspensky asked him to teach. And so he taught in England all during the war, and because of somebody wrote down all his talks, so we have volumes and volumes of his teachings, which are quite lucid and a really good, elucidation of Gurdjieff's teachings. So, and he's the one we're going to hear from tonight. Oh, there's one more guy I should mention, and that's Fritz Peters, which we'll hear. This is a picture from 1979. No, this is when he was a young boy. He spent some time with Gurdjieff, and he wrote a most charming reminiscence about spending time with Gurdjieff. You really get a sense of who Gurdjieff was from Fritz. We'll get to that later. So back to Nicol. Oh, we can turn it off. Okay, so this is Nicol talking about the work. And we should understand that as spiritual life, spiritual practice, yogic sadhana, working on yourself, however you want to term it. He says, all this work is in us, only we've forgotten it. The work taught externally is to make us remember what we have forgotten. One ancient philosopher said, all knowledge is remembering what we once knew. And see, that struck a bell for me, because that's Greek philosophy, Plato. I think Socrates, in those dialogues, is always trying to prove that people already know the truth. He says he only is, nursemaid or something. What's the word he used? He used to milk the people and get the knowledge out of them that was already there. That's what he said. And interestingly, parallel, in Shaivism, the doctrine of self-recognition, Pratyabhijna, says that knowledge of the self is something that we knew once but have forgotten. That we knew that who we were, but we've forgotten it somehow. Some fog has come. I like that. I like that better than building a self. I like the idea that somehow some obscuring confusion has happened. I've seen it happen in life, that people have a luminous understanding of who they are, and then some strange fit takes them, and they become like different people. But of course, eventually they'll return to themselves when the madness ends. But we're all in the grips of this kind of forgetfulness of who we are. So he goes on. Here's his explanation. All knowledge is remembering what we once knew. All such ideas are based on the view that man has fallen to a level lower than into which he was born. Pardon me. Well, that's a general view. I remember Wordsworth had that view, that we're born full of divinity. Everybody knows that. You see a baby, and they're full of higher consciousness and divinity and joy, and then gradually they acquire personality and become reprehensible human beings like the rest of us. True? Anyway, he says, what is it into which we fall? We fall into personality, especially false personality, which makes us ascribe all knowledge to ourselves, and in this way we get reversed, the wrong way round, and regard nature as seen through the senses as having created itself, and even imagine we have created ourselves. That's one way of talking. But Gurdjieff used to talk about two things, essence and personality. And when you have too much personality and very little essence, you become a certain way, which is too civilized, and you lose touch with the heart, you could say. And then he would say that like people who live outside the cities might have more essence, but not highly developed personality, while in the cities it tends to develop personality and lose essence. He says, now a person who begins to understand and to try to will the work in himself or herself starts upon a path, a journey, which belongs to himself or herself. First he or she is taught, and I'm not adding the she, this is what it was there, it's pretty good. He or she is taught from, you think I'm just adding that, right? From outside about observation, non-identifying, not considering, not being negative, and remembering oneself. But after a time, the questions that they may ask about what the work is concerned with become answered internally rather than from outside. That means such a person is beginning to make contact with the work internally. And we would call that an awakening. We can hear about spirituality. At one stage, when I got the spiritual bug, I started reading everything I could find. And I thought it made sense to me, but it didn't really. And it was only after receiving Shaktipat and having an awakening that things started to really make sense. And you could say then the work was happening inside. And that's true of all of us. When we start to awaken, we get inner messages. We may not pay attention to them, but that's to our detriment. But we get an inner knowing that comes. He says, as some of you have heard many times, this work leads to contact with higher centers with which we have lost contact, owing to having fallen under the hypnotism of external life and the power of the five senses. And he would talk about the higher emotional and the higher intellectual. And you could say that the higher emotional is divine love, and the higher intellectual is an experience of divine light and oneness. He says, at first this external life of the senses satisfies us, but after a time it does not, because we realize that we have no center of gravity in life, and any turn of events can rob us of what we imagine we value most. Everything depends, when you don't have a center of gravity within yourself, everything depends on how your life works out. When things go your way, you're happy. When things go the other way, you're miserable. So there's no center of gravity. You just go up and down with stuff. And let me tell you something. And I'm not the first to say it. It's stacked against us. Because as the Buddha pointed out, there is old age, disease, and death. And because of that, that game of externals is a losing game. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's just a losing game because there's inevitably these things. You have temporary victories, and then these other things will come in. So then the spiritual quest is to find a permanence that despite the difficulties of living in physical reality, we can transcend those difficulties by being so strong in our inner self. He says, a man loses all his money and commits suicide. That's an example of somebody who has bad luck and then life's not worth living. This means that his center of gravity was in his money and not in himself. Or you're miserable because your baby left you. I woke up this morning and Lucille was gone. So my center of gravity is in Lucille. Right? Now, if we're not born self-creating unfinished organisms, there'd be no possible center of gravity to reach other than the one given by outer life. In short, there'd be nothing else but outer life. But all through the ages, it's been taught that there's something else apart from money and possessions, fame and beauty. At the same time, it's very difficult for any of us to realize this deeply. The hypnotism of external life is strong. So you're battling with a very strong force. And the whole culture is arranged that way, telling you you have to be rich and famous and beautiful and young and thin and all these things, and constantly emphasizing what you need externally. That's a good summary of the work. How are we doing? Well, I think we should go right to the story. I have a very good piece about good householder, tramps, lunatics, and hostumus. But that's long. All right, we'll skip to Fritz Peters. It's a book everybody should read. It's just so charming. This little 12-year-old kid was left by his guardians and spent a couple of summers, I think, with Gurdjieff in France. And Gurdjieff taught him in the most adorable way. He became Gurdjieff's attendant and cleaned his room. And he got direct teachings. And he writes about it beautifully. So here, Gurdjieff has told him to come every morning for his lesson. And he had no idea what the place, the priori was about. We would call it an ashram. But to a kid who's 12, what are they learning there? And they had a lot of professors digging holes in the lawn and things like that. They couldn't make any sense of it. But he would go to his, he'd go for his lessons. So he says, when I went for my lesson the following morning, Gurdjieff looked very tired. He said he'd been working very hard most of the night, that writing was very hard work. He was still in bed and stayed there throughout the lesson. He began by asking me about the exercise that had been given to all of us to do, and which I referred to previously as self-observation. Okay, so now he's going to describe what self-observation is. And I think everybody has to do it who's practicing spirituality, maybe not in an organized way. I could also say it happens spontaneously with the awakening. You start to see yourself in different situations, and you suddenly see how you react. And it's a revelation because you hadn't been aware of that before. He said, Gurdjieff said, it was a very difficult exercise to do, and he wanted me to do it with my entire concentration as constantly as possible. to focus on what this mechanism does, how it reacts to everything. He also said that the main difficulty with this exercise, as with most exercises that he would give me or any of his students, was that to do them properly, it was necessary not to expect results. It's one of the chief things about yoga. If you read the Bhagavad Gita, it says that karma yoga is to do the work that you have to do without expecting results. And so the same with meditation. That's the problem I had at the beginning of my meditation, is I was straining for results. And because that, my mantra, instead of Om Namah Shivaya, was something like, when will I get there? When will I get there? And when will it happen? Not that I had any idea what it was that was going to happen, but, you know, and so I had to renounce that, and had the revelation, which I've often talked about, that I could never have the meditation I wanted, but I could always have the meditation I was having, which was whatever's happening is what's happening. And that's it. And that's good enough. So, not expecting results. In this specific exercise, what was important was to see oneself, to observe one's mechanical, automatic, reactionary behavior without comment and without making any attempt to change that behavior. So that's a couple of things. Without judging yourself and without trying to improve yourself, just to watch it. The machine does this. And sometimes when you see it, you start to hate yourself and you want to change and all that. He says, no, just watch it. He says, this is Gurdjieff. If change, he said, then we'll never see reality, we'll only see change. When begin to know self, then change will come, or can make change if wish, if such change desirable. So in the early phases, when you don't really understand, any change you make will probably be for the worst. So he's saying that later you'll have the capacity to change. He went on to say that his work was not only very difficult, but could also be very dangerous for some people. This work not for everyone, he said. For example, if I wish to learn to become millionaire, necessary to devote all early life to this aim and no other. If wish to become priest, philosopher, teacher, or businessman, should not come here. Here only teach possibility, how become man such as not known in modern times, particularly in Western world. The possibility of higher consciousness. He then asked me to look out of the window and tell him what I saw. I said that from the window all I could see was an oak tree. And what he asked was on the oak tree. I told him, acorns. How many acorns? When I replied rather uncertainly that I did not know, he said impatiently, not exactly, not ask that, guess how many? I said, I suppose there were several thousand of them. He agreed and then asked me, how many of the acorns would become oak trees? I answered that I suppose only five or six of them would actually develop into trees, if even that many. He nodded. Perhaps only one, perhaps not even one. Must learn from nature. Man is also organism. Nature makes many acorns, but possibility to become tree exists for only few acorns. Same with man. Many men born, but only few grow. Tell me if you like this teaching. You like this, or is it, too... Well, it's wonderful, but is it too depressing?
No.
Only few grow. People think this waste, think natural nature waste. Not so. Rest become fertilizer. Go back into earth and create possibility for more acorns, more men, once in a while more tree, more real men. Nature always give, but only give possibility. To become real oak or real man must make effort. You understand this? My work, this institute, not for fertilizer, for real man only. But must also understand fertilizer necessary to nature. Possibility for real tree, real man also depend just as fertilizer. This is his way of talking, imitating Goethe's talking, which is very effective, I think. What do you think of that? Yeah. So how would you square that with your, how do you accommodate that into your brain? Seems undemocratic, doesn't it?
Effort's the key.
What?
The key is effort.
Effort, yeah.
Well, it's not like Baba who said the self is within all
people. Well, Baba emphasized that the self is within everyone. But he said, but it's true that not, you know, Baba gave a very simple teaching, but very few really took it. You have to see the importance of it. And then you have to also believe that it's possible for you. You can be a tree, oak tree. You can be oak tree, and you take it on. And I profoundly believe that everyone can be an oak tree, and everyone is destined eventually, in some lifetime, to be an oak tree. But why not now? Why not now? Why not be the best you can possibly be? Live for the highest ideal that you understand, and be all in on it. Yes, ma'am.
You could say
go to Ganeshpuri, for example.
Exactly. You could say that the acorn is the self, and that the oak tree is just the realized self, because all of the acorns grew from the tree. So it's like
that's very good. Well, he's going to now talk about his theory of the self, which we'll disagree with, but. Okay. After a long silence, he continued, "In West, your world, is belief that man have soul given by God. Not so. God only give possibility for soul, not give soul. Must acquire soul through work. But unlike tree, man have many possibilities. As man now exists, he have also possibility grow by accident, grow wrong way." There's a wrong crystallization, he says. "Man can become many things, not just fertilizer, not just real man, can become what you call good or evil, not proper things for man. Real man not good or evil, real man only conscious, only wish acquire soul for proper development." So he's saying it's not to become virtuous or to become powerful or anything, but only to be more fully developed, more conscious. Fritz writes, "I had listened to him concentrating and straining, and my only feeling, I was 12 then, was one of confusion, incomprehension. I sensed and felt the importance of what he was saying, but I did not understand it." As if aware of this, as surely he was, he said, "Think of good and evil like right hand and left hand. Man always have two hands, two sides of self, good and evil. One can destroy other. Must have aim to make both hands work together. Must acquire a third thing." This is his doctrine of three forces, isn't it? First force, second force, and third thing. Here we are. "Must acquire a third thing, thing that make peace between two hands, between impulse for good and impulse for evil. Man who all good or man who all bad is not whole man, is one-sided." So that's interesting. That's very Jungian. It's to integrate the shadow and so on. So he says, third thing is consciousness. Possibility to acquire consciousness is already in man when born. This possibility given free by nature, but is only possibility. Real consciousness can only be acquired by work, by learning to understand self first. Even your religion, Western religion, have this phrase, Know thyself. This phrase most important in all religions. When begin know self, already begin have possibility to become genuine man. This really is wonderful, isn't it? So first thing must learn is know self by this exercise, self-observation. If not do this, then we'll be like acorn that not become tree. Fertilizer. Fertilizer which go back in ground and become possibility for future man. Well, terrific, huh? What do you reckon? David, what do you think of that?
Great.
Anybody have something to say? I'd love to hear it. It's brilliant, isn't it, in its own way. Do you object to the idea that you don't have a soul? What?
Maybe at some point we all did not, and we had to make, like maybe the original God or creator had to make that first effort to be, something like that. We all have to kind of do that ourselves.
I don't think you can square. I mean, I think, like Keshmir Shaivism says, that everyone is Shiva, everyone is the self, and that we're contracted forms of it, and we have to expand who we are and become back to what we originally are, which I think makes a lot of sense. But the way he came at it too also made sense within itself. I think you can get there a different way. Yes. He's talking about something else, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's building your permanent eye, your center of gravity. Yeah.
I think perhaps the analogy, too, has value as a motivational value.
Yes.
To try and wake you from your stupor and inspire you to be more.
You could say it was a strategy that he was coming to people who never had any yogic background, and he was looking at it, he came at it in a material way almost, and said that you should work on yourself, you should learn. That's a completely radical thing. Whoever tells you, who told you, who was the first time you ever heard of the possibility of working on yourself? I'm asking you an actual question. That never occurred to me. Even into my 20s and all through university and graduate school, nobody ever talked, no professor said to me, you have to work on yourself, know yourself, go deep. Never. It was not there. So when was the first time you heard about it? Huh?
In my first AA meeting.
AA meeting, yeah. Well, they do have, that's a very mysterious thing. They have the idea of calling on a higher power and developing, yeah.
I think people who are trying to,
when did you first hear about it?
Let's do the discipline of training for something. Because you have to really unblock your ego to actually...
That's not quite, yes, it's true. It's true.
Sports people would probably...
It's true. It's true, but it's not quite the same. You know, to be anything really good, to be a good actor, a good athlete, you have to struggle with your own resistance and you have to grow your understanding and so on. Yeah.
I guess you could say that the billions of people on the planet is only, a very tiny percent who are doing real spiritual work.
Yes. That's right. And a few people in Trump's cabinet. Well, there's religion and to do spiritual. No, there is a percentage of people who are doing spiritual work on the planet. It's probably not at this stage of evolution a very high one. And I think if everyone wrote down what percentage were doing it, we'd know more about who wrote you than about the actuality. If you're optimistic, you'd give a higher percentage. If you're pessimistic.
Definitely a lot more than Gurdjieff's time. Gurdjieff's time would have been such a small minority.
Certainly in the West, yeah. That's true. The idea had not come in. The idea is coming into the Western culture now, as we see in many ways.
Would you say it's leaving the Eastern culture?
That's what?
Would you say it's leaving the Eastern culture?
No. It's moving from the East to the West. They're becoming materialistic in a way.
Yes.
But I don't think so. I when I go to India, I see the depth of it there. But, we had, in 1970, there were two trains running, you know. There was all these people going to the East from the West for spirituality and drugs, you know. And then a whole train of people from India coming West to become engineers and things. and rich. So you can't generalize about these things, but... Very interesting. Good. What was the other thing? What did you have to say?
Oh, I wanted to ask for some clarification.
Go ahead.
I'm just having a hard time conceptualizing where Gurdjieff is coming from. So.
That's a mystery. I would say this. He was a very compassionate, profoundly insightful spiritual teacher who tried to help people grow. That's who he was. A lot of very eccentric and very humorous too. Very smart.
Right at the end of the book, it's just after the war. Fritz Peters meets him, and he's helping lots of people all around him with food and medicines.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah.
He said whether they become spiritual or not.
Yeah.
So he's very, very compassionate to everyone.
Compassionate, yeah. And I think it's better to think that everyone is going to become a tree.
Mm-hmm. Fertilizer is a good thing.
What?
Well, you need fertilizer for a lovely garden.
Yeah. Well, with fertilizer that the forerunners become trees, we'd be fertilizer. Let them grow, and then our turn will come.
Perhaps you tolerate the difficult people in your life because you think they're fertilizer for my growth.
I used to think like this. I think, what if some of my guru brothers got realized before me, and I would feel jealous. Then I think, no, that'd be cool. They'll help me, because they'd be realized. They wouldn't be jealous. They'd want to help me. So I said, that's good. Let them all get realized. I changed my understanding.
Later in the book where he learned American slang, he revised and said perhaps the word shit was more appropriate than fertilizer.
Well, there's not much difference. All right, let's meditate. It's always provocative and interesting. So we'll meditate. So to meditate, we look within. And we go to that place that is most intimate, most central, the place that answers to the question, who am I? The place where I resonates. When you say, I am, that place vibrates within you. And that place is strong and eternal. And if you get to know that place, your life is transformed. And you become very strong. And you become less at the mercy of external events, less at the mercy of other people and their judgment, and become much stronger in yourself. So let's meditate for 10 minutes. And sometimes the mind takes us away from focusing on that place, the clear space of good feeling inside, space of the self. It's very useful then to say the mantra, Om Namah Shivaya, which is our the mantra of our tradition. You can repeat that and let thoughts fade away and come back to that clear space within. And we'll meditate now for 10 minutes. And once again, with great love and respect, I welcome you all with all my heart. Satguru Nath Maharaj Ki Jai. Let's meditate.